girls out here currying favors. No more primetime crusaders. Blue vesters investing like they traders. For stocks exchange, they sold lousy traders. They serve massive edition like they waited.
Hello and welcome to We Cut Heads, a Spike Lee podcast. I'm your host, Spencer, and with me today is... I'm going to skip the dumb intros. It's Joel. We're at the end. I have senioritis.
Yeah, and if you had said I was an evil preacher, it would have just been you telling the truth.
All right. So, this is the final special episode, secret episode. At this point, I'm not sure. It's just another episode. This is one on... civil rights icon, actor, singer, political activist, Paul Robeson, and with us as returning guest, Antoum Egant.
Hey, peace. What's going on? Good to be here.
Yeah. So, for people who haven't heard your other episodes, who are you and what do you do?
I am a filmmaker, formerly an actor. But I still act, but, you know, not something that I pursue actively outside of my own film work. But I'm a filmmaker, and I'm also a film professor over at Purchase College. And an artist, you know, and lover of film.
Oh, okay. And I can't remember when on Twitter or Facebook I saw you, like, talk about Robeson, but that's when I realized he'd be perfect for this. Uh-oh. So what's your... can you even remember the first time you learned about Paul Robeson?
You know, I learned about Paul Robeson pretty early. Like, I don't know who got it for me. It was someone in my family. It might have just been my mother. So I'll give her credit, even though I might be misremembering. But my mom should get credit for a lot of things. But my mom had got these collection of, like, you know, famous important Black people books, and, you know, it's like these, like, books for, like, young people to read. And it was like 10 different, like, you know, maybe like 40 page picture books of, like, important Black figures. And he was one of them in there. And I remember seeing it, always being fascinated about this, like, you know, this actor, singer, athlete, you know, this person who was just this super cross person. And then, you know, that's, and I'm talking about pretty young. I'm talking like before, like 10 years old, like 8 or 9.
Oh, wow.
And I remember, like, knowing who he was, and he kind of never left my consciousness. He always kind of came back and forth. But I can't say I really dug into him until around my college years is when I began to really kind of, like, take a real interest in learning about him.
Oh, okay. Joel, can you remember the first time you heard of Paul Robeson?
It must have been recently, within the last couple of years or something like that. And I can't even remember a specific context. Like, you know, I figure I must have heard him sing Old Man River because that was just around for some reason. But, you know, like, I remember watching I watched some documentary that was free on Vudu or something like that. That was 100 years of Black cinema, and they talked about Paul Robeson in that. And then I think in the Song of the South series that Karina Longworth did on You Must Remember This, I think she dips a little bit into it. Mm. But I can't remember exactly when.
Oh. For me, it's similar to Antoum Egant, where I got a book on, like, famous African Americans when I was maybe 11 or 12, and there was a part on Paul Robeson. And so it was always like, this guy sounds interesting. But then I just kind of never bothered to, like, dig deep until very recently. And now I'm like, I wish I would have, like, done this deep earlier on. But
I'm curious, and then did you know about, like, the blacklisting back then too, or did you just know him as, like, a towering figure? Because I remember when I started like learning about him as an actor, then I quickly got to the whole like stuff that he got in trouble. And I was like, oh, this is interesting. And I think in college, that actually was what made me go back more than anything. Outside of his art, I was curious about it because he got it. You know, the U.S. government did so much effed up stuff to him. I was like, whoa, what did this cat do? What's up with this guy?
Honestly, when I was 11 or 12, I probably got to that part and I was like, that's kind of boring, because I was real obsessed with Russian history at the time, which is ironic given his connection to the Soviet Union.
Soviet Union, yeah.
Yeah. But like at the time, I was like trying to teach myself the Russian alphabet and like memorizing all the czars. And so like, you know, like black history at that time for me took a backseat.
Interesting.
So since it's about... So, for people who aren't that familiar with Paul Robeson, just a little background on him. He was born in 1898. He is a son of a former slave. He was a real good student. He got an academic scholarship for Rutgers, and he's the third black person to ever go to Rutgers. And he played football there, and he was All-American. He played professional football for a couple years, pre-NFL era, for Akron Pros and Milwaukee Badgers. And then he also went to Columbia, got a law degree. And this, and like the more you dig into his life, it's like he did like everything. Yeah. Like he traveled the world. Allegedly he could speak about 12 or so different languages. I haven't found a definite number on how many he could speak. Do you want to get into like the political side of him and like the big controversy that happened to him and that got him blacklisted?
Sure. Help me if I'm missing anything. I know, you know, after kind of building up a bit of a career for himself, doing plays and stuff like that, like he has like one of the longest productions of, I think he has the, or maybe at the time, he had the longest running Broadway production of all time. I don't know if it still stands or if it was like at the time or something like that. I can't remember the exact thing. But he was he supported a lot of civil rights causes and a lot of pro-Soviet policies and things like that. And he had a connection, you know, like a lot of people at that time to a kind of, you know, communist pro, you know, left position. That, you know, by the time of the end of World War II, McCarthyism kind of turned its head, and he was one of the, you know, the people round up in McCarthyism. He was, you know, denied a passport by the U.S. State Department. You know, he ended up being like really, 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 really broke, like pretty quickly going into that. You know, he couldn't work, and he couldn't, traveling was a big part of his career before that, like going to London and all over the world as being a singer and a performer. And the thing about it is he Robeson wasn't one of those people who, like, I think once he got blacklisted, who like went into a corner. He actually just kept talking, and it really forbid him from ever really having a career after that. It's not like you know, anything. It kind of like you know some people. It's funny. I was just watching rewatching the Landlord and like Lee Grant. I watched the interview with Lee Grant, and she talked about how she was blacklisted for 12 years, which I didn't actually know. I didn't know she was blacklisted. But then she said, you know, by the time, you know, the late 60s hit with In the Heat of the Night and some stuff, you know, she was able to be fine, you know, but Robeson never really got that opportunity for himself. You know, he had some comeback tours, but like, you know, at the level of this guy's skills, no, he never really, you know, and I know he had, you know, some health troubles and had to retire and so forth and so on. And, you know, but he stayed with, he was a big part of the civil rights movement, though, even though he was old, you know, and very sick. He was still very much a supporter of civil rights and did all he could.
Yeah. And I looked into it earlier today, and it, the big thing. Well, first it was he supported the Republican side of the Spanish Civil War, which Republican doesn't mean the same thing as over here. This meant the people who were against the fascist regime.
Yes.
And that got the attention of the U.S. government. I'm sure they probably were on were following him before that, but that kind of really, that was the first big thing. And cut to after World War II, and he is going to deliver a speech. I think it was like San Francisco. I forgot where it was exactly. And the speech got leaked, and it got misquoted, and then because he was a leftist, and he used like a lot of language about civil rights and that in criticizing the American government, he was labeled a communist traitor. He went from apparently like 150,000 a year to 3,000 a year.
Wow!
He couldn't tour, he couldn't perform concerts as much, and there is one concert he performed in a fairly liberal area of New York State that got attacked by KKK and anti-communists, where they were burning effigies of him, and they were throwing rocks and beating the crowd. Wow. And he was called the Black Stalin and the Kremlin's Voice of America by HUAC. And it got to a point that one of his supporters and friends, Jackie Robinson, was basically pressured into speaking out against him. Later Jackie Robinson in the 60s, towards the end of his life, he regretted doing that. And
I know for many people who like I know people of that era who don't like Jackie Robinson because of that. It's funny. I remember I had a family member, and I didn't understand at the time. He'd always be like, "Fuck Jackie Robinson," and he was like, "What he did to Paul Robeson, that should never be forgivable. He's a house Negro, such and such." And I was like, "Okay," but I was too young to really understand. And then I remember when I read about that, I said, "Oh, that's what my family member was talking about." And he was, you know, he was like, and by that when that happened, my family member was like, you know, in his 20s and radicalized. So Jackie Robinson for that generation, for some of those people, became this kind of symbol of, you know, towing the line and being a kind of, you know, a foot soldier for the man.
Yeah. And NAACP, they were also pressured into distancing themselves from Robinson because they were doing good work, but they also tried to not associate with anyone who was communist or socialist. And the most famous, I think probably most famous head of NAACP, Walter White, had to make a statement out against him, basically saying like, "We are not associated with him anymore," and you get the typical political nonsense. But Walter White is a fascinating figure on his own, but that's for another time. Let's see. And then Robeson was blacklisted, his football record was erased. His music recordings were destroyed, and his newsreels footage was destroyed, among other things.
That's ridiculous.
Yeah, and he was he got death threats, and you know, just he is getting like the poster child of like anti-Americanism, and it's like it's a whole bunch, you know, like it, you know, shit that you see today, and it's like, oh, it has never changed. It's America is still the same, which is very unfortunate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I mean, I got back into Robeson because of when I was in college, I started getting into, you know, I was reading a lot of like, you know, the Black Panthers. Like I was reading like things like Revolutionary Suicide by Huey Newton but I was still an artist, and I was really into Amiri Baraka and stuff like that, reading things like Dutchman, so forth and so on. And I then kind of remembered, I was like, wait a minute, wasn't Paul Robeson like, you know, a leftist? And that's when I learned all that stuff, and I really got into him. as kind of like an emotional figure, if anything, because of his politics and how he stuck to him, and it kind of was shown an example of, like, you know, having left politics as a black person in this country, even to this day, is just really a death sentence much of the time. And I mean, like, left politics, not like, you know, some kind of liberal stuff, but like really hard left, you know, anarchist, communist, socialist politics.
When he was being questioned by HELAC, he didn't confirm or deny if he is part of the Communist Party. I don't think really matters. If he was or not.
Yeah.
But
at that point, no. Yeah.
Yeah. It's just like so many things. It's so disappointing that so much bullshit happened, and he could have just had a bigger career and done so much for the civil rights movement. I mean, he did do a lot, but he could have done more, and he could have done so much more. But it's just the same shit that always happens. But he had a pretty decent film career, and I decided because we didn't cover any silent movies this season to do Body and Soul, a silent movie he did he starred in that was written and directed by Oscar Michaud. Joel, had you heard of Oscar Michaud or his movie before I told you we're doing this?
Negative.
Oh, really?
No.
Oh.
And get off my back.
Fine. And that horror movie documentary about black representation from last year, they talk about Micho in the beginning.
The only thing I remember is that Tony Todd said something, and I was like, oh, Tony.
Yeah, understandable. But, Anyway, Tume, were you familiar with Body and Soul before we decided on this?
I had never seen it, but I knew of the film, definitely. I knew of the film before you requested to see it. And I was actually very happy that I had been wanting to see it for a long time. But I had seen other Michaud films before that. I've seen about three before I saw Body and Soul.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And how would you sum up Body and Soul?
You're asking me? Oh, me?
Whoever wants to answer, really.
Sum up. Let's see. I'll jump in there. I would say a summary. It's like the story of it really is about the preacher. It's about a preacher who's not really a preacher. He's a con man. And he decides to, you know, he escapes from prison somewhere in Georgia, and he passes himself off as a reverend. Reverend Jenkins, right?
Mm-hmm.
And he has like a kind of a fellow kind of like accomplice criminal that he kind of rolls with. And, you know, he builds his congregation, so forth and so on. And he falls in love with this woman. Which I don't. Or does he really fall in love with her? I guess we can talk about that. And but she's in love with his twin brother at the same time. So he kind of manipulates her to like stealing some money that his mother that her mother has. And she should take the blame for the crime. And it becomes this big thing where it kind of ruins her her life, the young daughter's life, and. And for me, I guess it existed overall as this kind of question of like hierarchy and positions in the black community, which I think at the time there was no other more fertile ground to talk about that than religion, which is one of our original probably hierarchical institutions. I mean, nothing is independent of white America, but that kind of function within our communities at a somewhat, I don't know, independent. I don't like that word. I need a better word than independent. It's kind of like, you know, self-functioning, self-governing, maybe to a degree, kind of facet.
Hmm. All right. Yeah. before we started recording, like I said, I haven't seen that many silent films. Like this year, mm-hmm. I've watched the most, which is probably like three or four, including this. And like the first maybe 20 minutes or so, I found kind of hard to follow. And I'm not really sure why, but then once I have to go through notes, which I can't remember
I mean, it makes sense that you would have a difficult time following the beginning of the movie because it does do a lot of time jumps, and they've got that whole scene where, you know, the title card just says later, and then later in the movie we actually see what happened during that time. So
yeah. I agree. The first 10 minutes were a little confusing to me also, and I had to get my bearings. And I remember the moment. Like I can't remember narratively, but I remember a moment where it all clicked for me, and then I was fine. And I don't know if that was because I hadn't watched a silent in a while, or maybe flaws in the storytelling. It's probably a combination of both.
Yeah, it's a rough movie in terms of plotting. Like it's, I don't want to make it sound like it's bad by any stretch. It's like it's still competently made. It's just you can tell like Michio is. Like, he wasn't the best filmmaker in the world, but he was just, like, a prolific one, and there were other black filmmakers of the era, but, like, he's kind of the only one whose work really survived.
Yeah.
And so it's kind of, but the most striking things to me in this movie is just how versatile Robeson is.
Yeah.
This is the first movie I've seen by him. I also watched Emperor Jones today, but we can kind of touch on that if it comes up again. But I was really surprised. Like I didn't know, just like I knew he was a famous actor and everything, but watching this is like it's like seeing a corrupt preacher type figure. It's like it feels like almost like a prototype for Night of the Hunter little bit.
Yeah, that's good. Yeah, I like that. I never thought about that. That's a really good comp for sure. I agree. I was watching it and his performance abilities, you know, because he's so known for his voice, and like the first thing you kind of hear people talk about is like his voice. So to see him in a silent where, like, you know, his voice is not going to be used at all, be so incredible, like his eyes and his physicality. There's like scenes in that film, and I'll give Michio credit in the sense that I agree. I felt like technically, you know, definitely he had some things to be desired. Though I will say I will compliment Michio's boldness for wanting to kind of tell stories out of sequence and really like play with like time jumps and nonlinear storytelling. I was actually really impressed with that. But I'll give him also credit for capturing performance. I thought like that's such an it felt like such a unique performance, and that was Paul Robeson's first film. You know, and he really directed him well and gave him all the room to like do a whole lot of great stuff, and knew when to go tight, knew when to be large, knew when to be, you know, wide on him. I thought it was just really an impressive performance and a impressive capture of a performance for me.
J-Dog?
I mean, I don't really have any other thing other to say that what you guys have been saying. Like, it's interesting that, you know, he was a stage actor, Robeson. So they must have, I mean, the director must have laid out how important facial movement and expression and things like that were, because, I mean, it's his first movie, but it might as well be, you know, his 100th. Like,
yeah.
It feels like this guy knows exactly what he's doing. It's really great.
Like the scene, like the criticizing religious leaders was for me pretty shocking, because I kind of like literature and theater was doing it, but like I never thought of movies doing that like this early on.
Yeah, it was a no-no.
Yeah.
And well, yeah, like, there was an original cut of the one we have is not his original cut, and the director's cut is lost. So my feeling is it probably was even more critical than what we saw, which is crazy.
Yeah, like the only other like early black film that really criticized religion I can think of is Nothing But a Man, but I won't say even critical.
Gosh, that's
because like there's that scene where Ivan Dixon's character is with the preacher, and the preacher asks, "Do you even believe in God?" And Ivan Dixon's character is kind of like shrugged his shoulders, and they just move on from there. And like, and that's kind of it. Because like, it feels like even now it's not like they don't want to touch religion, at least like super mainstream wise.
Yeah, same mainstream wise. You saw it in the 70s, like ganja and hash has like those like interesting religious things about it. You know, kind of like, you know, the idea of church and your position in it, and then I think, you know, the kind of the idea of like the corrupt preacher in black culture, they kind of made jokes out of it, I think, after a while, like they, you know, like the crooked preacher type of thing, you know. But this is like, this isn't a joke. Like, you're watching Body and Soul, like this is pretty like hard hitting, man. Like there's no room for comedy in this one.
Yeah, like, he makes a heinous character altogether, but having the religious aspect to the thing, the con he's pulling, it just doubles down on everything.
And also kind of the reaction of other people. Like, I think one of the most blistering scenes in the film to me is not even so much about Paul Robeson, is when the mother, when the daughter reveals to the mother that it was the preacher who made her steal it, and she goes, or he stole it and, you know, made her say it, and she goes, "How dare you lie on this preacher?" Like, her first reaction is to think her daughter is like committing sin by lying on a preacher. Like, I was just like, whoa. I think I actually audibly said, "Oh wow," right? Like, she wouldn't even believe her daughter, and like, that to me, it's such a commentary, especially when you think about it now, of like, you know, kind of sacred cow black people who are like, you know, it's like, don't talk shit about Beyonce. You know, how dare you? But I have like empirical evidence that Beyonce did some wild Oh, how dare you talk about Beyonce? You traitor, you Uncle Tom, Barack Obama type stuff, right? People, you want to say about Barack Obama, you get black people who are ready to faint.
Yeah, like, they're still people. They're still fallible. They're not.
Yeah, exactly. They're humans.
They're not gods. And like, in this case, like, you know, he basically is a god to everyone until which, like, the big like when the mom goes to the service and tells everyone, like, I was genuinely surprised. Like, immediately everyone was like, okay, he's full of shit, and they turn on him immediately. Like, I was sure like it was gonna backfire on her.
I mean, it feels like a rewrite. Like, because I feel like the whole point of it is like, we don't question these people, and they often do take advantage. You know, whether it is just lining their own pocket or doing things and having people be in the position of not being believed, because why would a man of the cloth lie? You know, I mean, that was more blatant to me than like individual people. Like, this, the way even now our culture is so tied into the priest, or, you know, the Pope, for God's sake. It's like, trail off to no thought. That's my the end of that.
I really like the daughter character. Like, she's like the Robeson's a star, obviously, but like the supporting cast is also very very good, and I like that. You get the insert of the character and the actor.
Yeah.
Which I've as I said earlier, I haven't seen many silent films, but this is a first time I've ever seen, like, the character is introduced, and you get the insert of the name and the actor underneath, which I wish more silent films did that, because it's a very nice, convenient way just to do the credits and also just to clear things up for people.
Yeah.
Like, it's kind of fourth wall breaking, but it's not distracting.
Yes, I prefer the Thomas Edison thing. You know, the actors are not important. We don't want them to ask for more money, so don't even credit them anywhere in the movie.
Oh, big boss Thomas.
Yeah, I don't know, like, what to really say about this, because it's...
I think that the movie's interesting. Like, I haven't seen that many silent films, but I've seen more than you, Spencer. Mm-hmm. But, like, my favorite one is still what's it called? The Tale of Two Humans, or Sunrise, right? Which makes me a basic bitch, I believe. But I don't care. I really like it. And that, if you watch that movie, you get the feeling that they had money for sets and production design, all these things like that, because they're in that movie, they go to the whatever island to have one special night together before, I'm not going to spoil it. I know it's like over 100 years old, but you should watch it. But this one, you don't get the idea that they had like a lot of money for like sets or anything like that. Like, there's basically one, two, three like major set pieces, which is the house of the girl, the church, and then probably a tie between the bar and the room the girl ties in. Spoiler for this movie. And I think that the like I said, the caliber of acting going on and presentation of the story works just as well as Sunrise does. So I actually think this movie's pretty dang good.
No, I agree. I think that I think Michelle probably realized he didn't have the resources. You know, he knew he couldn't do Griffith stuff. You know, he couldn't do all that type of stuff that he was doing in terms of, like, you know, or Eisenstein in terms of, like, you know, size of production. But he really put it into the performers, and like he got some, like, really. I've watched Silence where I have to say I'm pretty bored by the performers. I'm just not that interested, right? I watched these performers and I thought they were like the mother and like those two women. I thought they were awesome to watch. That definitely the daughter. I thought the sequence when his accomplice was watching him preach, and you is like those kind of like medium, kind of almost like a medium close up shot of him looking at him, like, really good, like, facial performances, really emotional through the eyes, and good in a good frame to, like, really let us breathe with them. I thought, like, and then, like, rope, and then all the stuff with Robeson. Like, my favorite sequence was one of his preacher ones when he keeps hitting the guy and the guy falls down. That was amazing. I was like, this is and Robeson would just do these things that I can't describe, where he would, like, He had this thing with his mouth, and I always wondered what it would sound like. He would be like, it sounded like he was doing some kind of, like, weird, like, talking, and it was just great to watch. And I was like, I have to say, I was like, he's capturing some serious performance where, like, where I was maybe confused at times, or I was confused earlier, I didn't really care. I was just so into the performances, and I was trying to also, like, and probably it would take like a second watch to kind of like ascertain, was he meaning anything with certain types of his casting as far as like their skin shade. I was always very curious about that. And, like, you know, was he making any points around that stuff? I don't know. I'd have to rewatch it. But but like I said, yeah, I could tell it was minimal in their resources, but he did a really good job in getting some really great performers. And he probably what he did, I mean, look, he got Robeson. He probably went out and got some of the best black theater actors there were. That's what I'm thinking. He went out and got the best black actors out there who are like, who are the baddest people, and let me get them on film.
Yeah. And then going back to what you're saying about skin color, the Isabel, the lead actress, she's very light skinned, and continuing that light skinned women being more attractive thing, which on one hand it's like it's true, but at the same time, like, she also could gave a great performance also, so it's not pandering.
Yeah, I have a feeling there's something in the narrative choice of that too. I have a feeling he was trying. I think he picked her not because he thought maybe that. I'm not saying you're saying this, that he thought, oh, they're prettier, let me get a light skinned woman. I think there's something he's trying to make like a juxtaposition with. Like, I always felt like. Remember at the end when, like, the mother's having this kind of imagining that, for those, sorry to spoil, of the other role that Paul Robeson plays in it, the twin brother who's a scientist, and the minute she accepts him, even in her fantasy, is when he gets a contract, right? She wouldn't accept it the first time, and there's something to me that him being dark skinned, I don't know, something stands out about that, even though the preacher's also dark-skinned, but I don't know. I don't know, maybe my thought's inconsistent, but I feel like Michelle was playing with something. I just can't figure it out just yet. I would need a second viewing to really, like, kind of figure it out if what I'm feeling is real.
Okay. And I was bringing this up. You get the title of the movie in an insert at one point. Yeah. Which, yeah. I want to ask you guys, what do you think the title refers to, Body and Soul?
What do you mean, what do I think it refers to?
What do you think it refers to?
I don't know. It's a predecessor to Head and Shoulders, I assume.
Okay.
I mean, do you have an idea, Spencer, since you brought it up?
Well, at first, when it first happened, I was like, oh, is that maybe like the good brother and the bad brother? But then as the movie went on, I started to think that can't be it. So I'm not really sure. I feel like I need to watch it a second time.
Well, I guess if I'm like going into my head, thinking about it, actively, the first thing that comes to my head is kind of like who your body is in space, who we think people are. So, he's this preacher, so we look at him in a certain way, but is that really his soul, rather than the young woman, no one believes, her mother doesn't believe her. She looks at, I was like, why wasn't the mother believed the daughter? And I was like, because of kind of perceptions of, young women are tempting to like men and things like that and so forth and so on. So how we view her body, but her soul is really actually a pure soul. So I was like, maybe that these two things are separate, but they're not always intertwined is kind of maybe where I'm thinking actively, the body and the soul don't always match.
You guys are talking about the set design and how like it was limited, but some of it was very even though it was limited, like the house of the mother and daughter, Martha and Isabel, it felt lived in. It felt like individual, even though there wasn't much to it. It really felt like these people live here and. They don't have much money, and like this is all they can afford. And like you even get in the background on one of the walls, a portrait of Booker T. Washington, Lincoln, and Frederick Douglass. And there's another one that I think might have been another portrait of Booker T. Washington, but I wasn't sure.
Yeah, there was a Booker T. Washington portrait, and the other one that I remember it had Frederick Douglass. Lincoln and someone else on it that I can't remember.
Yeah, it was smaller and I couldn't make out who it was supposed to be.
Yeah, I remember those very, 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 very clearly. And I thought it very, because that was in the mother's house, right?
Yeah.
I thought it was very interesting that the mother had Booker T. Washington up there. I thought that was so, that was such a pointed, and Frederick Douglass and Lincoln, these kind of symbols of Reconstruction, you know, do it, you know, kind of do it. The cliches of them, like, I don't think, I think Frederick Douglass sometimes misrepresented. And even to a certain degree, Booker T. Washington, I've had to kind of do my reevaluation of how his legacy is framed as well. But I thought they were very interesting usages, because I think a lot of times they can be associated to people who are trying to be socially mobile, but, like, you know, do things, bootstraps and get your stuff together, and, you know, we are part of America, so forth and so on. I thought that was very interesting. Like, she didn't have, like, you know, Du Bois up there, right? You know, yeah. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, that really stuck out.
Was no Nat Turner or something up there, or no Harriet Tubman up there. It was like these other people. I thought it was very interesting.
Yeah, like for lack of a better word, like it felt like they got the respectable ones and not like the controversial ones.
Right. And that fits with the mom. You know, she's like saving all of this money, you know, and she's doing it in the quote unquote right way.
Yeah. What was it? I forgot. I was reading or listening to something where they're talking about a major theme of Oscars movies were respectability and like the middle class, which here I'm not sure if they're supposed to be middle class or not, but they did own a home, but like the whole theme of like respectability within the community like was very very like apparent, like that was like the like to them like most important thing is just you know, being like the good Christians who don't question anything.
Yeah, your reputation, you know, means so much in those moments.
I mean, you see a movie like Red Hook Summer, right? That's got a great representation of religion or religious leaders gone wrong, and like and no one ever criticizes that movie, so I think you can see lot to compare. Yeah.
Even the end where the end of this movie where the mom confesses that like the preacher is not who says he is, and Red Hook Summer has like towards the end the guy who reveals during a service he's not who he says he is. And also, like, watching this made me think, my dad's family is from West Virginia. They've been there for a long time. And this made me think of, like, I wonder, if this is what it was like growing up for my grandparents in, like, small town, rural West Virginia, where, like, they go to church every Sunday and, like, they try to be, like, respectable and, like, do everything the quote-unquote right way. And
I have to say, like, it's interesting, like the mom in the movie, she actually looks like a picture of my great grandmother. It reminded me of my great grandmother, and my grandmother is from Virginia. So when I watched this movie, and when I watched a lot of movies of that era, you know, especially made during that time, it definitely sounds like how my grandmother would speak about growing up, you know, and about those kind of people. And my grandfather died when I was very young, but it just sounds like that culture that they grew up in.
In the
South.
Yeah, it's same for me. Like, well, West Virginia, well, if you ask my family, they say it's the most southern of northern states, the most northern of southern states. It is pretty southern. Like, I've been there enough to, like, to really confirm, like, it's pretty much like a southern, a culturally southern, but like this and like the mom and daughter are light skinned, and a lot of people on our dads are light skinned, and like you're saying, like the mom looks like some of your family. Like, I could see like the some of my family in these characters, and
yeah
except you know they were My grandma, she was from a coal miner's family, so they had even less. And but still, like, just like the movie, just felt like how my grandma liked to talk about growing up.
I have to say, I really didn't dig the slang subtitles. Like, I know. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, the a certain level of authenticism.
Were you
offended? What I'm trying to say.
Were you offended by the N-word, Joel?
I'm always offended by the N-word, but
okay.
It has nothing to do with that. I mean, it's in the movie, and the daughter's like, that's a bad word. And mom's like, oh, okay. Like, I'll just make a note of this. Mm-hmm. But, like, that's another thing that probably would have been off-putting. I don't know your experience, but like the very first like speaking subtitle, I believe, is the guy who is running that illegal bar, and it's, you know, it's like broken English. Like, this, the way it's spelled out looks to me like somebody who's lost his teeth and doesn't have a replacement, not somebody who's speaking in slang. Hmm.
I adjusted to it quickly. I could figure out what it was.
Yeah, I guess, you know, it's interesting. I mean, I was used to it after, like, you know, there's like a lot of literature of that era that played with it. Controversially, though, that it was very controversial to do that. Like, I remember when Zora Neale Hurston did it in Their Eyes Are Watching God, many people didn't like it. They thought it like made black people look bad, so forth and so on, and you know, so it's interesting that Michel made that choice. That you kind of see where he lies in terms of presenting black people, you know, like he doesn't seem like a conservative in that sense.
Yeah.
I mean, like, I can, squeeze it down to its basic essence of being like, well, this way you can tell which people are educated and which are not, you know, like the daughter is a bit more educated than the mom. The mom uses slight slang. You know, this preacher guy, he's got some sort of, you know, I don't know if he was educated in prison or whatever, but he speaks clearly. And then, you know, his buddy who shows up is the same way. And then, but the guy who's already running the scam in town that is immediately overtaken by fake preacher, you know, he's got the worst of all, but yeah. And you know, I'm scraping at something. I'm not sure necessarily if that's true. That's just kind of the way I was reading it.
Yeah, I can see that. There was one sequence particular where it was the preacher with the money, and then it transitions to, I think it was Cotton, and then it goes to, I wrote down the around somewhere like what. Like all the transformations, but it's this really powerful sequence. Here it is. It goes, because the insert says blood money, then it cuts to women ironing clothes, then it cuts to Cotton, then it cuts to blood money again. And it's this really amazing juxtaposition of, like, I'm still not 100% on what he's trying to get at, but like, that whole sequence is like, is burned into my brain.
That is very striking imagery. But what was I going to say? I was going to say that 1925, they were doing that, but I'm just going to shut up. I agree, it was striking.
Okay, yeah. And going back to Robeson's performance, like, he is truly evil in some parts, and it
yeah,
like, we're talking about how, like, 20s silent movies can just be like really creepy, and like, his performance is genuinely like, there's an insinuated rape in the movie, and it's just so effectively like the gross and like distasteful.
Yeah, or when he beats the guy, you know, in the fight towards the end, it's just so rough. Even like his preaching moments, when you you already by that point know he's a complete con. He just feels like a frightening dude. You don't want to get on his bad side. His like his eyes, like, you know, are just like, woof. You're just like, this dude, woof. He got some bad thoughts.
I mentioned before he played football. Like, you can tell, like, he's just like a big imposing figure.
Yeah.
And you don't see much of the twin brother, but like with the twin brother, you get like a totally different physicality and different vibe. And it's just like the whole like playing twins thing is nothing new. But like when it's done poorly, you can really tell when it's done poorly. And here, like it's a totally different performance.
Yeah. Yeah, or when people like they try to like overdo it, like try to make them so different, you know what I'm saying? You're like, all right, dude, we get it. You're not brothers. I mean, you're brothers. You're not the same person. Like this one, it still has a good enough subtlety. You know, he's such a good actor that he's able to know like what ticks to make them seem distinctly different.
I don't have much else to say besides, I want to watch more. Here it is. There was a moment that reminded me of Psycho where all of Papa notes is creeping on her face and feet. But like reminds me of Psycho. I think that's...
When they go to his face and hit his feet on... It's like a profile shot, kind of.
I think
so. Yeah, that's a great sequence. I really liked that. I really liked that sequence a lot, actually.
Yeah, it definitely feels like Psycho or like De Palma, you know, kind of thing like that.
Yeah.
It's very good.
Yeah, I wonder if like Hitchcock ever saw this, but I mean, Hitchcock was active at the time, so I don't know how far Mitro's movies even got, honestly.
Hitchcock only watched Hal Needham films.
Yeah.
That is the thing about Michaud, and I would love to like meet like a Michaud scholar, because I'm very curious. Like, did his films get seen? Like how much circulation did they actually have? I've never really been able to get a really good word on, you know, the reach of his movies.
Like my grandpa is from, well, my mom's side of my family, they're New Yorkers, and most of them never leave, which is why I've never met most of them. But my grandparents were like the two that didn't like New York, so they left when they could. But my grandpa said he growing up, he remembers Mitro's movies playing locally. And this would have been... my grandpa was born in 38 or 37. And so this would have been like towards the end of Mitro's career. Because he died, in the late 40s. But he has memories of, like, at least seeing, like, the name.
Yeah, I'm so curious. I mean, I guess there hasn't been, like... I wonder if there's like, a definitive, like, biography out there. I know there's a documentary. There was a documentary on Stars about him, but I've never been able to see it.
We're talking about the filmmaker?
Yes, yeah. The filmmaker.
Yeah, I would love to see any of that stuff.
Yeah, I gotta try to track down that doc and see where I can find it, because it's called "The Czar of Black Hollywood," and I've heard about it, but I've never been able to track it down. I gotta try to track it down.
Yeah, and it's a race film, which we talked about a little bit on the Stormy Weather episode, where race films were just like the lower budget. Like films by black directors with a black cast, and there's a lot of them, and you can find a lot of them on YouTube in various quality, and I've seen a few of them, and this is the longest one, which was like this cut is like 90 something minutes, and the others I've seen are usually like 70 to 80 minutes, but yeah. Like, if you're curious about them, what I did was I just, like, searched on Wikipedia race films and found, like, the major ones. And they're all on YouTube because copyright, like, it says public domain at this point.
Yeah.
But, there's a whole bunch of, there are like Westerns, musicals, religious films. But, like, this is probably the best one. I don't know. Stormy Weather's pretty... I feel like I like Stormy Weather a little bit more.
Yeah.
But, this is still, definitely up there.
Yeah, I think, like, in some of the other Michaud films, like I've seen The Homesteader, which is definitely, I think, important to see because it's, like, the first one. You know, and then Within Our Gates, it definitely is a important film to see if you just want to, you know, on a historical basis. And definitely some of the... But Body and Soul, I will say, is, like, is... I think it's really good. It's something definitely like I'm gonna point people to check out. You know, and I'm glad I finally got a chance to kind of sit down with it.
Yeah, and there's to watch is it's just like, why didn't Robeson become a big star? And then you look into his life, and it's like, oh, that's why. That's why he never became a huge star. But Emperor Jones is his other big movie, which I watched because I've known about it for a little bit, and a friend of the show, Martin Kessler, is a huge fan of it. And
I saw it, honestly, back, I don't remember. I saw it many years ago. I saw it in high school because that play was always referenced to me as like a black actor, Emperor Jones. And, you know, that play, though, is kind of, there are definitely like people who love that play and there are people who don't like it. There's definitely a mixed bag feeling on the history of that play. When it comes to black analysts of that play, but I can't remember the film. It's been so long since I've seen it.
The film I like overall, but I don't know, I got some problems with it, but I don't want to dwell too much on it. But like the main big takeaways are, it reminds me of Chameleon Street and Throne of Blood.
Well, I know I'm almost positive Wendell Harris has seen it, so I'm sure if you brought that up to Wendell Harris, he probably would tell you whether or not like that stuff like Wendell like now Wendell, you could tell from Chameleon Street, loved the old silence. You know, he references Cocteau and stuff in it. So you know, in Chameleon Street, so you know he has a knowledge of that kind of stuff.
Yeah, and the whole like last 20 minutes or so of Emperor Jones is basically the end of Throne of Blood, where he is losing his mind. He's going to die by his own people. And Adrol, do you know what Emperor Jones is?
I mean, I know it's a movie, but I don't know other than that. Well, apparently it's a play, so I've been wrong for all these years. I'm so sorry.
Yeah.
Oh, but this guy becomes a porter for a railroad. I think the Pullman Railroad.
Pullman's Railroad.
Not railroad. Whatever. But the porter was like, maybe no, maybe then. But like it was like the big like, if you're a black porter on a railroad, that means you're moving up in the world. And so it's a nice little symbol of that. It shows up in a lot of stuff. But and he kind of moves up in society and takes different roles, and he like gambles, and it's like he's like analogy to gambling to like move up and stuff, and he becomes the emperor of an island in the Caribbean, and then he's a tyrant and is killed by his own people. But the whole last sequence is very like the end of Throne of Blood, except you get Paul Robeson instead of Toshiro, and like he's alone, and it's just a really, the movie has problems, and I've seen some, like, I feel unnecessarily hot takes on it, which is, like, I get it, but on the other hand, like, it's kind of, it's still important, that it exists, and that's still, like, is watched, like, it should be watched, because, like, it just shows,
Who are you subtweeting?
Letterboxd, I saw some takes on it I didn't agree with.
Entirely. I mean, that's Letterboxd. It's a hive and scum and villainy. I don't blame her, you know.
Yeah, but it definitely is worth watching. It's important. It's like Stormy Weather. It's a product of its era. Some stuff just doesn't fly anymore. Yeah. But it definitely should be seen, and it's just more proof that Robeson should have been a huge movie star.
It was written by Eugene O'Neill. It's one of his. It's actually Eugene. It was actually Eugene O'Neill's first major hit as a play.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's a name I know.
Yeah, that was it was actually his first like super big play. Or yeah, it was like right around the time where O'Neill was starting to kind of really rise up before, I think before like Long Day Journey into Night and stuff like that, but it was definitely one of his early big hits.
Cool.
Okay. And Tumay, do you like Stormy Weather? The musical?
You know, I have to watch it again. I saw it as a kid. Maybe even more. I think last time I've seen it as a teen. And it was never one of those movies that stuck with me. I'll be honest with you. But I've been meaning to watch it again, honestly, because I know it has such a big reputation. So I was like, you know, I need to watch it again. But so I can't say whether or not I like it or dislike it. I just knew it was never one of those movies that stuck with me.
Oh. Who was it? I think Gene Kelly. Apparently, his favorite dance routine in any movie ever is a Nicholas Brothers routine on the stairs.
Well, that's amazing. That is amazing.
Yeah, which I don't think I mentioned on the episode we did with Alexandria, but like that was mind blowing to learn. Like even Gene Kelly was like, these guys should have been superstars. Which is if it's Gene Kelly, you know.
I mean, people know, man. They see that stuff. They performers knew back then, like who were the real deal, and they were just like, well, well, you know.
Yeah, I mean, Nicholas Brothers did. They taught to Jackson, so and other big pop stars and shit. So, you know that, you know they got their some fame eventually.
Yeah.
Like I'm at my parents. I mentioned that movie to my parents, and my mom likes the movie, and my dad's like, "Oh, the Nicholas Brothers. I remember when they were real old on like Johnny Carson, and like that's his only memory of them. Is this like he didn't even know about their movies or like their work with like Jan and Michael Jackson?" Which,
yeah.
Which I'm not gonna get into Michael Jackson shit. Like just like him as a performer.
Yeah. Whole other podcast.
Yeah, whole different topic. Yeah, so I'd recommend, you know, watching Paul Robeson movies. There aren't that many, but like after Emperor Jones, I found like he was a supporting part for usually.
Yeah, he's in like Showboat and stuff like that. He's in he has a lot of supporting roles.
Track Down his music. I'm sure some of it has to still exist. Like
his book
on YouTube. Lots of stuff.
His book is also his. I read his book Here I Stand when I was in college, and I remember it being very, very a powerful document of that time. I mean, it's definitely like dated of that era, but it's interesting to see him blacklisted writing a book about. Here's what I'm gonna say about myself, and here's what I'm not gonna allow you to do to me. It was a quick read, like 120 pages, like a manifesto. It was really, but then like you know, it's amazing to watch this guy who's an actor, athlete, do all these things, write a literal political manifesto.
That's admirable.
I mean, like for real.
From my perception, people don't seem to talk about him very much at all anymore, outside of like. Like cinephiles talking about, like Emperor Jones, and that's kind of it. It seems like
Steve McQueen was supposed to do a film about him, but I think it's been either shelved or trashed. Like, not it's not going to happen.
No,
starring Michael Fassbender is really weird.
No, he would have Michael Fassbender be the evil white guy who keeps him down. You know,
definitely.
You know how it goes.
That's all he deserves to play now.
So he'd be McCarthy and maybe Chiwetel Ejiofor.
Right. Oh gosh, of course. Michael Fassbender is Joseph McCarthy. Oh my gosh. You know that would definitely happen.
Yeah. All right. So this is 1925. I don't really have any other 1925 movies. So instead, I'll just recommend my favorite silent movie, The Man Who Laughs, which is, I think, after a couple years after this. And it's the visual inspiration for the Joker. And it's just a very tragic movie. It's based off the... I just looked it up before. Robert Louis Stevenson. Where's the other guy? It's based off one of the big authors of the era, and it's and there's this guy with like this disfigured face, and it's kind of a horror movie a little bit, and it's also like this very, I feel like a Universal monster movie before those were a thing, because like even though he's kind of like freakish looking. He's still like a person, and you really feel for him. And if you haven't seen A Man Who Laughs, like, I'm doing a bad job selling it, but like it definitely is like an essential silent film to see.
I know the original Stella Dallas was done in 25. It's definitely, I don't think it's, I think the 37 film is the more famous one. But that's something to check out. And also, I think what, Chaplin has a film that you're, the Gold Rush, that's another one. But yeah, there's nothing else I could really think of that came out that year off of my head that I know I've seen. I've seen the Gold Rush, and I've seen the original Stella Dallas. Granted, it was years ago.
See, I haven't gotten to this part in my personal project to watch at least 10 feature-length films from every year. And, of course, when I get into silent era, feature length is going to be adjusted.
Yeah.
So, I watch Battleship Potemkin because you're supposed to. And, you know, it is very interesting. Not a let's hang out and watch a movie. And I learned that. I don't remember. Sorry, what was that?
I think Al started an episode on it. But
you turned it off.
No, like, it really seemed like, oh, this is... seems more like homework than like a fun movie.
Right.
It's a fun movie. I really like Potemkin. I'd be honest. Like that's a movie that I have a good time watching. You know, like this, there's some silence that feel like chores. That's one I enjoy.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
That one, Vampire is another one that I really think is amazing to watch. It doesn't feel like homework.
Yeah. Vampire is amazing, yeah.
And there was another one. Joan of Arc. Passion of Joan of Arc is another one, too. It's me. I love watching that, too.
I don't like that lady staring at me.
I love it. I think it's rough. It's highly emotional, but like don't watch that movie at night.
Yeah.
She'll haunt you. She'll haunt you. Her eyes, it's really like heavy.
I'm already being haunted by the real Joan of Arc. I don't need her additional ghost here.
You don't need Falconetti on you, man.
The only other one I've actually seen from 25 is Seven Chances, and I don't remember it, but you'd have a really hard time not watching a Buster Keaton movie that was funny, or finding one that wasn't funny, because he was incredibly talented and very, very funny.
Yeah. I feel like this might be a controversial opinion, but I like Keaton more than Chaplin. Chaplin is more emotional.
That's not controversial.
It's fine. Chaplin is like more emotional and like a movie star, but like Keaton is just like pure, like it's like purely funny, pure cinema. Like he's like under, like I with him I get more of a sense of like he's portrayed like he's an engineer. And like trying to figure out, okay, what's the best laugh I could possibly get from this? But he also understands how to make a good movie. Where Chaplin is more like, I'm a movie star.
Hmm. I thought you were going to say Harold Lloyd, but okay.
I haven't seen any Harold Lloyd yet.
He's okay.
Yeah. Yeah, I think there's many people who would tell you that they like Keaton more than Chaplin. I don't think it's a hot take.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I mean, I love them both. Chaplin does feel more kind of like pure cinematic. Like he was an artiste with an accent over the E. Yeah. And Buster Keaton just knew how to make funny, funny stuff and was willing to do slightly life risking things on occasion.
Slightly?
I mean, he would definitely be killed by that falling down house thing. I think every time. But yeah.
Is Seven Chances that the one where there's like a water hose or something?
See, I honestly don't even remember. I know it's the one that was remade as The Bachelor, starring that guy who played Robin in the Batman and Robin movie. What's his name?
Chris O'Donnell.
Christopher O'Donnell. Yeah. Oh, really? Oh my! I never knew that.
Yeah, it's terrible. That one's terrible.
Oh god, that sounds bad.
But there's one Keaton movie, it's one of them I haven't seen, where there's like a stunt where like a bunch of water like falls on him, and he apparently broke his neck. during the take, and he didn't realize it until about 10 years later. He's at the doctor, and the doctor was like, what happened to your neck? He's like, I don't know. Like,
his head broke it. Backwards.
And then in the x-ray, he's like, okay, what did he do in your movie? And he went through, like, a bunch of stunts or whatever, trying to figure out what stunt it was. And so he's like, I think it was when a bunch of water fell on the back of my neck.
It was either the stunt where the water fell on me or the part of the movie where a guy hit me in the back of the neck with a hammer a bunch. For comedy.
This will come out late September, or this will come out before the Sex Lives and Videotape episode. That much I'm sure of, whenever that will come out. So, Tume, thank you for coming on.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
And I believe you have a new podcast.
Yeah, I actually have a podcast named after Oscar Micheaux's film Within Our Gates, called Within Our Gates. Yeah, we just about six episodes in. We do, focus mostly on Black film and also, like, perspectives around, Black ness within the film industry, but also from, like, a kind of left, kind of leaning perspective on a lot of that stuff too. So yeah, definitely come check us out.
Yeah, I highly recommend the Watermelon Man episode.
Yeah, with the homie Trevor from Champagne Sharks. Yeah,
yeah. I started listening to that show because of you and Marcus, and
yeah,
I really love that show. It's so good.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, but Watermelon Man episode, and we also did a Watermelon Man episode like a year ago or so with Martin Kessler. That's more about Melodram Peoples, but Kessler's like a big Van Peoples freak. Well, the first two movies, but J-Dog, will the other episode of the Vampire one be out?
Oh, I don't know. When is this one coming?
A week from now or so? Week and a half from now?
If I get time to work on it tomorrow, I've already started editing it. Yeah, it'd probably be up by the middle of next week. We've released two episodes on the Dead Travel Fast, our vampire podcast, which covered the original Dracula, or not the original Dracula movie. Technically, it did cover the original Dracula movie. Okay, yeah. Anyways, the first one, Dracula, 1932?
One. 31.
Yeah. One, two, three, four. And first chapter of the novel Dracula, episode 2, on the movie Nosferatu, not the one from the 70s?
Yeah, 70s.
The original one.
Yeah, the 70s one.
That's 22.
70s one is okay. Kinski is great, and some other casts are great, but overall it's not essential.
Either way, we didn't cover it, so just forget I even mentioned it. And the second chapter of Dracula. Our third episode, coming soon, will be covering Horror of Dracula from the 60s?
50s.
50s, yes, starring Christopher Lee, the ones that were made by the Hammer Studios, as well as the third chapter of Dracula. And then we'll be moving on to that, our next series. But those should be up, and they're available in all the regular podcast places. Dead Travel Fast podcast.
Cool.
We got to figure out a movie to get our guest on. I guess everything else you want to hear from me, if you want to hear me talking about science fiction and fantasy movies, I had a podcast called Please Don't Send Me Out of Space. It's on hiatus. But there's 150 plus episodes of jokes and fun, and I miss my friends so much. Okay, I'm not going to cry on air. Anyways, it'll come back someday.
Eventually. And for me, I was on Bradley Cornish's Movies from Hell podcast, which might be out by now by the time this comes out. We talked about Eliel Petri, this great leftist popcorn movie director in Italy. Watch a popcorn movie. But he made, like, mainstream entertained movies with a very strong leftist view of the world in Italy. And he was similar to Robeson. His work got destroyed and well, some of his work got destroyed, and some of his movies are impossible to find because he was too critical of the Italian government, and we kind of cover that. Wow. Yeah, but it's if you ever heard Movies from Hell, you know it's kind of messy and all over a place, but a fun, but still a fun time. But what else? I was on Grindbin recently talking about a really dumb movie, Street Trash. I like it. It's really stupid and gross. But if you want something stupid and gross and offensive, I watch Street Trash. And yeah, that's it. And after this is Sex Lines Videotape, then Do the Right Thing, and then our final episode, which is a wrap up on every covering like the whole season.
Oh wow.
Yeah. So, see you guys next time, and,
all right, y'all.
Yeah. Stop recording.
Oh, wait, I was about to go, Old Man River.
The show's email is highandlowpod@gmail.com. It made no sense to change email, so it's the same feed. The show can be found at podbean.com, and Spotify, and other places you can find podcasts. Please rate and review whenever possible. The logo is by Josh Hollis. The music is by James Fell, and thank you for listening.
No equity in their labor. Brand culture by tool of the enslaver. A ice grill, so one ice larger than glacier. And straight shooting North Star, avoiding the chaser. Last call, blast all to mass fall. We bastards with black creed and fast draw. And raise storms, black queens beyond norms. Black excellence, black power's your platform. But Negro liberals keep it uncivil. You shot your axe, need to shut up and dribble. We hammer and sickle, manifesto we scribble. Poison Alexa, scribble y'all can do. We on the night, our skin be the symbol. This finger's new, Jack be nimble. And Seth is speaking every riddle with signal. From our revolution, we loading our pistols.